welcome you to the Trauma Informed Educators Network podcast. This podcast is coming out of the Trauma Informed Educators Network Facebook group. I am so looking forward to talking to people globally about their trauma-informed journey. As the principal of Fall Hamilton Elementary School, a trauma-informed school in Nashville, Tennessee, I have learned that this is not a destination, and it truly is a process of learning and adjusting. So this podcast will be speaking to guests all over the world about people who are just starting their journeys and people have been on this journey for many, many years. So I hope you enjoy our guests. I hope you learn something just as I am. And welcome to the Trauma Informed Educators Network podcast. This is episode number 49 of the podcast. And today I'm going to be talking to Dr. Warren Larkin. I had the amazing privilege of speaking before and meeting Dr. Larkin in England just a couple years ago. In 2017, he founded the Warren Larkin Associates, but before that, Warren spent 24 years in NHS, working predominantly with individuals and families experiencing serious mental health difficulties. First as an assistant working on a long-stay psychiatric ward at Prestwich Hospital, and then as a clinical psychologist in Manchester, England, working in a service created to provide and research impact of CBT and family interventions for people experiencing psychosis. Warren went on to lead one of the two national centers of excellence in psychology care for psychosis, chosen to share an innovative practice in First Episode Psychosis Services, which is FEP. This initiative contributed to a case for change, which led to increased funding to the introduction of a two-week referral to treatment time in FEP services in England. Warren then spent 5 years as a network clinical director responsible for children and family services across Lincolnshire. Warren was responsible for quality and safety of care for research and innovation. This experience led Warren's passions for public health and prevention work. Warren is a consultant clinical psychologist and is also visiting professor at Sunderland University, where he is working with the Faculty of Health Services and Well-being to develop the research program and training curricula for a broad range of healthcare professionals. Dr. Larkin has worked so many different places, and right now he is working on a global initiative around trauma-informed shifts to cultures and system. So here is what Dr. Warren Larkin had to say. All right, we're about to jump into it. Are you ready?
Well, good. Yeah.
Ready or not, here we go. All right, just one second. All right, Dr. Warren Larkin, welcome to the Trauma Informed Educators Network podcast. And I don't know if you know, this is actually episode number 49, which I feel like 50 is such an awesome number when we're talking about talking to people around the globe. And you certainly are going to give us a global perspective. So welcome to the podcast. How are you? And as I start every podcast, tell us about the Dr. Warren Larkin experience of life.
Well, first of all, thanks, Matthew, for inviting me. I see you've had some very esteemed and prestigious guests on before me, so I feel privileged that you could find a space for me. I think it's a tremendous initiative that you've developed, you know, having got to almost 50 episodes and sharing all this learning around the world. I think that's fantastic. So that's one, you know, I really appreciate you inviting me. My story, well, I guess there are a lot of stories about how I got here, and I'm trying to work out the right one for your audience. But I guess I'll go with the high level story. So I'm from a town in the northwest of England called Wigan, which is kind of a working class town that basically thrived on industry and coal mining, you know. So that's the kind of place I grew up in. My dad was a coal miner, and his dad was a coal miner, and my mum's parents worked in the mills, in the cotton mills. And we grew up in a smaller part of the town of Wigan called Ince. And I'm from a you know, decent working class family. My dad was a professional rugby player. Rugby league. I don't know if it's got a funny shaped ball like your American football, There you go. Not quite usually that weird of a show.
I've actually watched rugby, and it's funny because I put on Twitter just, I guess it's been like 2 weeks ago, I'm like, I watched this whole game, and I literally do not understand the whole concept of the game, although it is very interesting to watch.
It's entertaining, and it's a hard game. And but yeah, I'd say the same about American football. It's very confusing. But so I grew up in that town, and rugby league, there's two forms of rugby, rugby union, rugby league. Rugby league was generally from the north of England, and my dad did two things. He worked in the pit digging coal, and he also was a professional rugby league player. So I went to a school in the town, and my experience at school wasn't very good. I didn't enjoy it. I didn't feel safe. I didn't feel valued. I didn't feel I belonged in the school. And as a consequence, I don't think I've reached my potential. So I kind of left school kind of having survived it rather than having experienced nourishment and growth and value in education. So I kind of finished school. I left my secondary education with, I think, two GCSEs or O-levels, as we call them in them days, but two qualifications. One was in woodwork and the other one was in religious studies. Which wasn't too great, really, Matthew. I mean, my dad said to me the only person he knew that made a success of those qualifications was Jesus's dad. and he couldn't think of anyone else. So I was like, well, okay, what am I going to do? I honestly left secondary school thinking that I was stupid. I thought I left secondary school thinking I wasn't very bright. And that's the message that I'd taken away from my secondary education. I remember the careers teacher saying to me when I went for my interview that I wasn't bright enough to do A-levels, so I'd better go and get an apprenticeship, and if I could get a job working with my hands, which is what I tried to do. But because I hadn't passed maths or English, I couldn't get an apprenticeship. So I decided my only option was to go to the sixth form college, the further education college, and to resit my exams, to do my maths and my English and, you know, the things that I needed to get on in life. And when I did that in a different environment, I was so shocked that learning was easy. So when I was in an environment that felt safe, that felt respectful, predictable, wasn't characterized by chaos or threat, where the teachers made you feel valued, where you felt respected, and you felt connected to the school community, suddenly my potential was unleashed, and I realized that actually I was actually pretty smart. You know, I could learn. I passed the exams for maths and English in, I think, 3 months, from having no confidence in those subjects to passing the exams. And the teacher said, well, why don't you do A-levels? You know, why don't you do A-levels and think about university? And that was the first time it even crossed my mind. So, yeah, my journey through education was an interesting one, and it's absolutely an accident that I'm sat here talking to you today, because there was no plan to go to university. There was no plan to do any of that. So, yeah.
And, you know, I think the cool thing, Dr. Larkin, is when I was in England and we got to meet in person, as we spoke at the same conference, that night before the conference, we sat and you shared that story, and I shared mine, which was very, very, very similar in nature. And I talk about often that I didn't even realize I had the potential to do anything until I really hit almost graduate school. That undergrad was such a difficult, challenging time for me. It took me a long time to get through school. And it was because I was convinced that I didn't have the ability to do it. Then I hit grad school, and it's like I had a 4.0 in grad school. I had a 4.0 in my post 30 hours of graduate work. It's like, because I found an inspiration of what I was meant to do, and then I had people validating it. And so I think that's such a powerful message that all educators need to hear, is that sometimes we have to be cognizant on our perception of what kids have the ability to do, because it can be skewed. So let's talk about your work now. You've got a lot going on, and you've had a lot of experience. Let's get into your experience. You have worked in psychiatry. You've worked in all kinds of clinical settings. Can you talk us through kind of what all you've done? Because it's a lot, and you have a ton of amazing experiences.
Well, thank you, Matthew. yeah, it's been an unexpected journey. So I went to university in Hull and I studied psychology because it was the subject that fascinated me the most. And from there, I kind of, when I left university, I started volunteering in psychiatric institutions, trying to get some experience. Like I said to you earlier on, before we came on to the broadcast, you know, from the moment I walked into a psychiatric institution, I was both shocked and fascinated by what I saw. Number one, shocked by what I saw in front of me, you know, the way people were disabled by what was going on in their minds and the way people were treated, you know, in those contexts. So that was fascinating for me. And I didn't really understand it. I didn't understand why people would be in hospital, but there would be no plan for them to leave. There was no expectation of them getting better. I found that really confusing because in those days, a lot of people stayed in hospital for their whole lives, you know? So I worked in an institutional setting, which was one of the last asylums in England called Prestwich Hospital. And some of the people who'd been there had lived there for 40 or 50 years. And they'd gone into the hospital for a break for 2 weeks, apparently. This was the original plan, for one or two weeks to have a rest, and they never came out.
Wow.
So this was the end of the containment movement, the end of the mm-hmm. asylum movement, mm-hmm. and it was followed by an initiative at the time called Care in the Community. So the idea is we'd move people out of those institutions back into society. But after 30 or 40 years of living in that setting, people were institutionalized. And people were helpless. They'd learned helplessness and they couldn't care for themselves. So I guess there was a big question about whether what we're doing to people was ethical by moving them back into the community after living their whole lives in this protected environment. But I guess the thing that stuck with me from that very, very early experience was the only thing that people really seemed to have in common was that they had something bad happen in their lives. And that fascinated me because it was never talked about as part of their treatment. It was never discussed as part of the solution. It never was mentioned as part of a discussion about a patient's care or a person's care. So I became fascinated by that because I think, well, it can't be a coincidence that something bad happens in someone's life or they experience something very stressful and then they struggle to cope. And suddenly we give them this disease, this label called mental illness or psychosis or in those days schizophrenia, and that determines the course of their life. So it's from that moment I figured there's something about trauma, there's something about extremely stressful life events that make it hard for people to cope, and I guess that was the start of my journey, really, Matthew.
Wow. And a powerful one too, for you to have the intuitiveness to go, wait a minute, something, there's a connection here in a lot of spaces. And how many years ago was that? I'm not aging you, I promise. I've never.
No, I'm old. I'm 50. I was 50 in February, so I'm officially very old. I say to some of the students that I teach, do you remember before the internet? And people just look at me blankly. No. You know? Yes. I'm like, no, there was a time before the internet. Yeah. So this was in the early 90s. So probably about 26 years ago. This was when, you know, when I was doing that work as an assistant on the wards at Prestwich Hospital. And then from that, I was lucky enough to get a job as a research assistant and a job as an assistant psychologist. And I worked with some amazing people who were doing research into life experience and how trauma might influence the onset of serious mental health problems. And that was considered extremely controversial at the time.
Right.
Because there's been 100 years of people, you know, 100 years of the psychiatric system and the medical system saying the reason for serious mental health problems is inherited genes and faulty brain chemistry, you know, the chemical imbalance theory. And I remember being taught at university that, you know, one of the leading theories about why people develop schizophrenia, this word we don't use very often these days, fortunately, was because people had too much dopamine. So they inherited genes that made them vulnerable and they had too much dopamine and this made them express crazy ideas and develop this, what they describe as a brain disease called psychosis or schizophrenia. So that was kind of, you know, that was where we started. So this idea of researching the impact of life events on the onset of psychiatric problems and in the maintenance of psychiatric problems was pretty controversial. You know, in fact, extremely controversial back then.
And, you know, I'm listening to your journey and I'm thinking about when you talk about controversial, I feel like as science continues to progress, we're in this constant state of disruption, right? Which the whole point of this is Disruptors Unite. It's a hashtag I've been using for a long time. Because it does take a disruption of challenging systems that we know aren't working, right? And when I say aren't working, I mean for all kids or people. And I think for some reason in education, we feel that kids are expendable. And when I say we, I don't mean me, but as a global system, like we don't have time for this kid because of this issue or because their parents don't care. I hear that way too often. And it's not about that, right? It's about these experiences. And so your work, although is not directly connected to education, it is. Because it's all interconnected. When we're talking trauma-informed systems, we mean every system. And you've got an initiative that you are working on now, right, that is trying to connect global systems, and that's called the Global Resiliency Accelerator. Tell us about that, because I'm blown away. And a colleague of yours was a guest on here, Becky Haas. So you guys, and I'm assuming more than just you two, are working on this accelerator. So tell me about it. I'm very intrigued.
Well, it's an embryonic idea. We've had one meeting so far. And it came from, I guess, from talking to Becky. I made a connection with Becky because I read about her work on ACEs Connection, and it's only recently that I made the connection that you are in the same town, same state, or not too far away anyway, which was amazing because I don't know why I didn't make that link. But yeah, so we made a connection, and I've been working, obviously, in the UK and Europe, looking at how we can, you know, my work goes across the whole spectrum, everything from, you know, working with a small team, trying to support them and give them confidence and skills to ask people about adversity in a sensitive way, all the way through to working with leadership teams, you know, or non-governmental organizations and government agencies, you know. So looking at the way systems operate and looking at how we can change outcomes for the next generation, you know, so we're looking 20 or 30 years ahead. So the idea for the meeting, for the Global Accelerator meeting, was basically that I recognized after talking with Becky and other people like yourself that in the US and in other parts of the world, you know, there are advances in thinking, there are advances in practice that maybe we haven't yet begun to understand or implement in the UK. And equally, there are things happening in the UK that maybe aren't so common in the US, you know. So that was where the idea came from. And we figured that because obviously, you know, we're still in the middle of a global pandemic, we felt that adverse child experiences are becoming more and more relevant to everybody, not just people who are interested as educators or working in care professions, but to everybody in society, because the consequences of the pandemic are that the social and psychological impacts on people have just accelerated the problems. They've widened the social inequalities. They've worsened poverty for people. They've increased the amount of exposure people have had to trauma. They've cut people off from their sources of resilience. So we figured that the problem is a global one, and we need to learn from each other. And the more we can share ideas and thinking and support one another as professionals in different sectors, you know, your journey in terms of your life journey started off in some ways similar to mine, but where you've chosen to focus your efforts is in education. I've chosen to focus my efforts in, you know, mental health initially and then more broadly around leadership. So we figured a global opportunity to talk and to share thinking and good practice was sensible. So we had the first meeting a couple of months ago, and the second meeting is happening on the 16th of August, and we've got an incredible guest which we're very excited about. I don't know if you want to tell us who that is, Matthew.
Well, I know him really well. It's actually me, and I cannot wait to share the story of transformation of the school that I'm so fortunate to lead. And to be quite honest, I think what you said is so key. This is a global effort. This isn't something that's isolated to a city, a state, a country, a continent. This is a global effort, and I've had people on here from both the UK, and I've had somebody from New Zealand, and I've had somebody, if I think from Kenya, if not, she needs to be on here. I can't remember if I interviewed her or not. I've had a lot of people, and I think the important part of that is this is global, and we have to get together as a like-minded people. And I don't mean we all think the same thing. I think we all have the same perspective of where we want to see things move towards, and have a think tank and process this information and say, what does it look like in the UK might be different than what it looks in the US, but ultimately the outcomes are all going to be the same, which is very well-connected people who have strong, stable, nurturing relationships to buffer any trauma, and ultimately eliminating any barriers that create trauma, right? We know that. And I think it's so powerful. So if people want to get involved, how can they get involved in this? Because I think that a lot of listeners are going to be interested in it.
Well, I hope so. I mean, on the first meeting, we had almost 100 people sign up, and we had people represented from, I think, 15 different countries. You know, the people, we were seeing the sun come up behind some people who were attending the meeting. So it was really encouraging. People are really committed to this movement. And so the way you can get involved is, hopefully we can post a link to the event alongside the podcast, and we're going to do some social media activity in the next few weeks running up to the event. And basically it's free to attend. We're going to have a wonderful presentation from yourself, Matthew. We want to hear about the amazing work you're doing in education. And then we're going to have a Q&A session where people can share their own ideas and also ask questions of you, and other participants can contribute as well. And it's going to be a combination of keynote speakers like yourself, as well as development sessions, networking opportunities, special interest subjects. So it's going to be basically, the content's going to be driven by the survey responses that we get after each session. So
awesome.
In a nutshell, that's where we're at.
Well, and I'll be sharing on Paradigm Shift Education and also the Trauma Informed Educators Network, both not just the podcast, but also the network. I'll be sharing links to that for listeners who listen to wherever you do. I'll be sharing that. And please join this, because this is a global movement. And as many people as we can have moving, I know that Jim Sporletter says there's just not enough people out there having these conversations. There's not too many conversations happening. We need to have as many as possible. And so such a great piece. So let's get into, you wrote a book back in 2006. Is that correct? Is that the correct year?
I edited a book. This book here.
Oh, got it.
Product placement, Matthew, you see.
Hey, I see. Nice work.
Oh, God. There we go.
Yes.
Trauma and Psychosis.
Okay.
New Directions for Theory and Therapy. So this was in 2006. It was edited by myself and my esteemed colleague, Professor Tony Morrison, and it was the first book on the subject.
Mm.
And again, as I say, it was extremely controversial. And in fact, on the back cover, one of the reviewers says, this is an important, a kind of a paradigm shift,
which
challenges the ascendancy of a traditional biological model of psychosis. So very much in line with your mission, Matthew. We set out to challenge the traditional view, the received wisdom. And we assembled all the best evidence that we could, and we got all the best authors that we could from around the world, and all the best clinicians and researchers. And we put all of it in that book and said, here, what happens to you in your life matters. What happens to you in your life, if it's stressful enough, it's bad enough, can trigger an episode of psychosis. And that can happen to any one of us. And it's, it's too simplistic and it's too reductionist to say it's simply down to the genes that you're born with and the neurochemistry that you happen to have. That's far too simplistic. What we know is that, for example, 70% of people who develop auditory hallucinations or hearing voices do so after a traumatic life event. The vast majority of people who get this label of paranoid or paranoia, most of those people have had bad things happen to them, Matthew. Most of those people have had people hurt them. So is it a surprise? Is it a sign of madness that they're looking out for signs of danger all the time? Is it madness that they're scared of other people? Well, probably not. I'd say it's a sign that evolution's in operation. And when people have been hurt a lot, they struggle to trust people. They struggle to feel safe. And when you've had bad things happen, it's hard to function in the social world. So that book was really a challenge to that purely biological, biomedical perspective on mental illness. And it was about saying we have to start recognizing the impact of life events on people.
And that was your first edited, but now you're writing your own. And I think that I would love to like read that one and then read when you're new. And I have not read that book, but I definitely will be trying to get my hands on a copy. But reading, and you're in the midst of writing a new book. Tell us about kind of what your thoughts are through this new book, because I would assume that there's a lot of perspectives that have stayed the same, but there's probably some that have changed.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really good question. I mean, I've been talking about this subject for at least 25 years. And I published my first paper in this field in 1999, which was looking at the impact of psychiatric admission on trauma symptoms. So what we wanted to know was, does being admitted to a psychiatric hospital when you're experiencing psychosis, does the way you're treated, you know, being restrained, maybe being secluded, maybe being given medication against your will, being in a place that you don't feel safe, where you're scared, you don't, you know, reality isn't making sense to you. Maybe you're having distressing beliefs. Does that experience, is that traumatic? You know, is that experience traumatic? And we looked at a group of people who are in hospital who'd experienced the first episode of psychosis, and we assessed them against PTSD clinical scales for PTSD. And what we found was about 42% of those people met criteria for post-traumatic stress disorder based on their experience of admission. Mm. So we talk about trauma-informed systems. Very often, and this is a perfect example, the systems that we create to support people who are unwell can inadvertently traumatize people. So that study in 1999 pretty much demonstrated that we need trauma-informed systems. We need trauma-sensitive environments for people when they're vulnerable. So again, the link, you know, a link that's followed my work all the way through. So I guess the book I'm writing now, lots of similar themes. You know, I'm still talking about the same things. I'm still talking about, let's ask people what happened to them when they're seeking help. I'm not suggesting we drag people off the street and we screen them because they're 40 and they're probably at risk of something, you know, like prostate cancer or whatever. But what I am saying is, if people are in services, if people are coming to professional sites for help, ask them what happened to them. Mm-hmm. Ask them about their life. Don't avoid questions about trauma, questions about adversity, because as professionals, we're worried that we might upset someone, or we're not trained as a therapist, or we're not a social worker, whatever it is. And I appreciate it can be a reasonable concern to not want to upset somebody. But I also think if someone's coming to ask for help and they're struggling, and the odds are, you know, based on the population surveys, half the population has at least one adversity. 70% of the world's population report at least one traumatic event at some point in their life. The odds are they've probably experienced something difficult, and that may or may not be contributing to their problems. Mm-hmm. So we should at least ask them respectfully if they want to talk to us about that. Then we should ask them if that's still happening, because we need to protect people. If it's a young person or an adult, we still need to protect them. And then next, ask, do they think it's relevant? Is what happened to you relevant to why you're seeking help today? Do you still feel troubled by what happened to you? Mm. And by the way, I believe you, and thank you for telling me. Mm-hmm. I appreciate you trusting me with that. So I'm still talking about some of the same things. You know, let's ask people what happened to them. Let's respond in a therapeutic way, in a kind and compassionate way. Let's see the impact of systems and environments on people that are already vulnerable. You know, let's not re-traumatize people. So many of those things are still the same. What's a little bit different about this new book is this was an academic text. It was three parts. The first bit was very theoretical, like presenting the case for change, presenting the evidence. The middle bit was about specific populations. And the third bit was about therapeutic approaches. This book, the one I'm writing at the minute, is going to be far more accessible, I think. Mm-hmm. It's aimed at a general readership. So members of the public, professionals, and anybody that's got an interest in the subject, really. So it's pretty mainstream. I think what I've tried to do is start off by telling my own story.
Powerful.
You know, how I grew up, how I experienced certain things that were difficult, and then how I ended up struggling through education, how I came out the other side of it, and why I became interested in trauma. So that's the first part of the book, the first couple of chapters. And the second part of the book is about, you know, what exactly is trauma? What are we talking about, and what does that mean for people, and how do people recover from it? Because I think this is one of the potential pitfalls with, you know, the field that we're trying to educate people about, is that people talk about trauma and adversity and resilience and all of these things, and very often it means different things to different people.
Absolutely.
So what I want to do is say, well, not that I've got the definitive version, because there are books and books about trauma, and there are people far better qualified than I to, you know, to give you the definitive account. But what I tried to do in the book is sum up my 25 years of experience working as a clinician, as a researcher, as an academic, and as a leader, and tell you what I think is relevant. Because, you know, most people haven't got time to read a lifetime's worth of books about this subject. Mm-hmm. Where to start is the difficult thing. So what I've tried to do is say, what are the key concepts and ideas that are relevant based on my experience? These are just my own choices. So sure. I was writing a chapter today about trauma, and I've talked about this idea of having shattered assumptions. So this idea of when something really terrible happens, when something really stressful happens, your previously held beliefs about yourself, the world you live in, and the people around you are brought into question. The things that allowed you to get out of bed in the morning and go about your business carefree, that reassurance is gone, because suddenly you've gone from a world that is benevolent and predictable, where people are generally good and decent, and you're a competent person that can generally cope with things, to a worldview that says the world isn't benign, the world isn't predictable, the world isn't safe, people can't be trusted, people will hurt you. And I'm not very competent. In fact, I'm a bit vulnerable, actually. I've made some, you know, I've demonstrated that I'm not capable. So that's one of the concepts that makes it really hard for people to recover from trauma, is that it changes their worldview. It changes how they feel about themselves, the people around them, and the world they live in. And that can be extremely debilitating. So one of the challenges for people who've been through a traumatic event is to regain that emotional and psychological equilibrium, you know. And one of my clients said to me years ago, and I always remember, she said, I've got to get from a point where I think everything's threatening to a point where it's back in perspective, where this all makes sense to me, and it doesn't go away. I can't undo it. But I've retained some perspective, and it becomes live withable. So she invented this word called live withable. You know, it's never going to go away, but it has to become live withable. And I said, okay, well, that's what we're going to go for. We're going to try and make this something you can live with. So that's part of what I'm writing about. The next chapter is about adversity, the whole childhood adversity study, why it's important, some of the questions about it, some of the really important issues that it raises, and where it takes us. I'm talking about trauma-informed care, this idea that was first espoused in 2001 by Harrison Fallot in their famous book about mental health services. And I'm trying to talk a little bit about, well, what is trauma-informed care or trauma-informed practice? What does it mean? What are the key aspects of it? Because there are lots of different versions, depending on whose work you want to look at, whether it's SAMHSA or the CDC or whatever. So I'm going to tell you in the book what I think my pillars of trauma-informed practice are. There's a section on resilience, because that's a massive subject. It's huge. And it means different things to different sectors and different professionals, depending on how you've been trained, depending on your perspective, your worldview, or the discipline that you're from. It means something different in sport to what it means in education. It means something different in mental health to what it means in, you know, public health. So I'm going to talk about, in the book, I'm talking about resilience, but I'm also talking later on about system change and policy and practice change. And because I think when you get to this point of recognizing that most people who struggle, who have issues that need help, people that become vulnerable, often they've experienced trauma or adversity in childhood, in other words, developmental trauma. That's one assumption. Let's create services that are more effective, more sensitive, more holistic for people that have been affected. So that's going to benefit everybody. But we have to go past that and say, okay, once we've created services that are sensitive and responsive and appropriate and empowering for people, then let's get better at identifying who's been affected by trauma in the first place. Let's help them sooner. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, let's move upstream to a point where we apply all this knowledge and technology that we've got to prevent trauma and bad things happening to people in the first place. Because the Centers for Disease Control, the United Nations, Public Health England, Public Health Wales, all the major, you know, all the major UNICEF, all the major kind of organizations who comment on public health and world, you know, a worldwide kind of health and well-being, they all conclude that the ultimate goal should be prevention.
Right.
And we do, ironically, and this is the thing that I still find really challenging, is that we know what works in prevention. We know what prevents poor outcomes in physical health, in social well-being, and in mental health. But yet those interventions and those programs are not readily available. In fact, they're the first things that get cut, that get removed, that get decommissioned when finances are tight, when we enter a recession, mm-hmm. or there's a pull on public finances following something like a pandemic, for example. So they all agree that if we have a long-term cross-sector collaborative approach over a generation or more, we could see a massive reduction in childhood trauma, we could see a massive reduction in drug addiction, we could see a massive reduction in poor health as a result of obesity. You know, we could see huge improvements for the next generation. But currently we have a system that is disjointed, is siloed, is disorganized. It's not integrated enough. Mm-hmm. And leaders often, by the time they get to the top of their profession, they're so specialist. You know, I was a specialist for many years. I worked with people with a first episode of psychosis that experienced trauma. I was pretty specialist. It was only when I stepped back and took a public health perspective that I realized more and better therapies is not the solution. The solution is prevention. The solution is moving upstream, is helping children and families. The solution is helping a family who's struggling to put food on the table. You know, a solution is making sure families live in environments and neighborhoods that are safe, where there are safe adults available to those young people. You know, they're the solutions.
And, you know, I think that's a conversation that we've got to extend when you're talking about education. This isn't just about being a strong, stable, nurturing relationship for a traumatized child, right? This is about creating systems and networks that support the families and the community, right? Yeah. And it's interesting that you say that, because you see the conference below you that we're having. One of our partners, it's called Stop It Solutions, and it's actually a self-reporting app that families, students, anyone can self-report that they need help or support, right? Whether it's mental health supports, whether it's food support, whatever it is, and then it connects them to the right network to get those support. And I think when you talked about using technology, that's the first thing that popped into my head about how can we be inventive where people can also self-advocate. Like, I'm struggling right now. We have these little pods in small communities, like my school. We have a family resource center that has, we have everything from food to diapers to clothing to connections to family services and all kinds of things. But that's not every school. And so it's like, how can we work in a smarter technological way to support our families and kids? And I think that's so powerful. And you're right. We need to end trauma. We don't just need to respond when there is traumatic experiences. So Sandy has a question for you, and I'm going to read it here. I'm going to put it up here and then I'm going to read it. Do you think that most DSM labels are just the genetic vulnerability to a certain expression of trauma? So do you feel like those labels that, and unfortunately, Dr. Larkin, in education, in order for students to get services under special education, they have to have a label, right? And the label that's mostly used when it comes to trauma is emotional disturbance. Yeah. And so It really bothers me, to be quite honest, as an educator, to give a student a label of emotional disturbance when we know it's actually developmental trauma. That to me, they don't, but psychologically we have to have these labels. What do you think?
I think there are a lot of problems with the categorical diagnostic system. I think historically it's been very unreliable. It's too easy to give out labels because fundamentally it begs the question, what's wrong with somebody, doesn't it? You know, by applying a label, you have to work out what's wrong with somebody. It's a pathological focused system and it focuses on pathology. And when you've got something like, you know, a broken leg or, you know, measles or a chest infection, yeah, you know, it's probably quite a good system. But when you're talking about psychosocial or biopsychosocial issues that arise out of developmental trauma, it's not so easy, you know, because most people's problems or difficulties and strengths and needs exist on a continuum. They exist on a continuum. We all do, you know, all of our tendencies and traits and strengths and vulnerabilities exist on a continuum. So putting people into a category, which is essentially an all or nothing label, you know, or kind of a diagnosis, it's problematic because as soon as you say to somebody, look, we know what's wrong with you, you've got psychosis, or we know what's wrong with you, you've got depression. And depression is, you know, for a long time been described as this chemical imbalance, you know. You haven't got enough serotonin, we'll give you a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, it'll make sure the serotonin lasts longer at the synapse, and before you know it, you'll be feeling better. But the problem is, as soon as you say to somebody, you know what's wrong with them, the whole system starts asking the question, what happened to that person? So, for example, with children, as soon as they get a label of ADHD, we know what's wrong with them. Problem solved. We just need to give them the right medication. And everybody else is off the hook. The school, the family, the community, the local environment, what happened in the past. All of those things seem to sort of evaporate in the presence of this new solution, which is the label, the diagnosis, because we know what's wrong with them, and the treatment that's been prescribed. So I think sometimes people can feel relieved that they've got a diagnosis. Sometimes that can be useful for a family or a young person, you know, if they're neuroatypical, you know, it can be helpful to understand that my brain works a little bit different to other people's. I struggle with social situations. I struggle with uncertainty. I struggle with novel circumstances, you know, if I've got autism or whatever. That can be super helpful. However, the diagnostic system as a whole is based on this idea of pathology. It's based on this idea of there's something being wrong, something's being broken, something's dysfunctional. And the idea is that we can, in psychiatry, that we can correct that with some kind of treatment. There's a concept in public health called salutogenesis, which basically means the factors that predict and promote health and well-being. So we have a system that's predicated on this idea of pathogenesis, of finding out what's wrong with people and trying to fix it. And what we do very little of in our society is focus on the strengths and the health promoting attributes that we can bring, which is where we come to the conversation about resilience. And what can we do to keep people well? What can we do to give families and children the best start in life? What can we do to help parents raise their kids to feel loved and to be as resilient as they can be and to be good citizens and good neighbors and good friends and parents themselves later on. So I think fundamentally we need a shift from this notion of our healthcare and social care system that's focused on pathology and fixing things and helping people when they're already in crisis with ever increasing thresholds. And we should spend more of our time and our resources thinking about prevention, thinking about preserving health, thinking about promoting well-being. So that's where I think we need to go, rather than the fixation with creating diagnoses, particularly in the field of mental well-being.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I know I've shared this experience before on this podcast, and I'm going to share it with you as a previous foster parent of two boys. You know, when we went through the process of getting them, I guess evaluated, you would say, and they both had severe PTSD. I'll never forget what the psychiatrist said. They said they have severe PTSD. However, we need to label it ADHD so schools know how to handle it. And I thought, say what? Like, you have to label it something else so that a school knows how to handle it. First of all, how schools handle students with ADHD in a traditional sense is definitely not handling it, right? That's not, to me, that's not handling it, right? No. But at the end of the day, you're right. And it's not just the, it's not just the mental health sector. It's not just the physical health, right? I know that that's all about symptomology, and there's a lot of traumatic experiences and responses physiologically and even neurologically that can present itself the as something that is pathological, yeah. Right? So it's like, yeah. we narrow our focuses in our sectors to the point where we're missing the big picture. And I think that it doesn't matter if you're in education, absolutely, you're in mental health, or you're actually in physical health. We just have to broaden the perspective, just like you said.
Yeah. And I think we the right questions to ask people are, why are you in pain? Why are you in distress? What happened to you? Do those things that happened to you seem relevant today? Do those things that happened to you affect you still? It doesn't matter what you call it. You know, it doesn't matter what label we give it. What matters is that we have a conversation with somebody. And that's why I like the idea of the adverse childhood experiences concept. Because if we start to say to somebody, look, lots of people have adverse childhood experiences, and here's a list of them, we know that those things can affect health and well-being. We know that those things can make it hard to cope in life. It can make it hard to have relationships. It can make it hard to function in school. It can make it hard to feel stable in your mood. You know, it can make you prone to addiction. Sometimes having those things in your life can make your life harder. Are any of those things relevant to you? And do you think any of those things might be accountable for the reasons that you're here today? That it doesn't matter what you call it, you know? And I think what's really fascinating, Matthew, is that until, I think it was 1980, before the concept of PTSD was created, and that was as a result of pressure from the Veterans Administration and other organizations, right, who wanted their members to get treatment, mm-hmm, under the insurance system. But that's the first time there was a condition in the DSM, if I remember rightly, that had an etiology or an origin that was based on life events.
Right.
So that was the first and only condition in the whole book that was predetermined and acknowledged the role of life events. The rest of it was all presumed to be, you know, other causes. So I think we've come a long way that today there's a huge movement surrounding this notion of adversity creating risk and vulnerability. I think we've come a long way that we're talking about trauma-informed practice, because both the ACEs study from 1998 and the publications around trauma-informed practice, I'd say for probably around 20 years, were pretty much ignored by everybody. No one was interested, you know. I think both for cultural reasons, I think it wasn't acceptable, or a bit like talking about suicide wasn't acceptable a few years ago. We thought that somehow that might be harmful to people. And today we know that if someone's depressed or is struggling with mental health issues, it's imperative that we talk about whether they're feeling suicidal, because then people are more likely to tell us. So culturally, I think things have moved on. But I also think economically, we're starting to recognize globally that unless we prevent some of this demand that's coming through, and we give children and families the best possibility of having healthy lives, well, then we're just not going to be able to cope.
I think too, Dr. Larkin, we're even moving past some of those pieces, and now we're talking about the historical context of trauma based off of marginalized people, whether it's indigenous or whether it's in the U.S., you know, our Black African American communities. Like, we're now getting to like drawing even further back, saying that trauma impacts generations of people, and the idea that you just can pull yourself up by your bootstraps and get over things, we know that's not realistic anymore. And we know that the historical context of trauma impacts communities for generations. And I think it's interesting, because even in the midst of all of this, Dr. Larkin, in my own state, we now have a fight against any type of conversations around race in schools. There's actually legislation now that has made it illegal to speak about race and racial theory in schools. Now, tell me that is not, it just blows my mind that we don't want to talk about the impacts on a national scale that slavery had on the people that currently live, or we don't even want to talk about the impact of the indigenous people when we came and came to the U.S. from England, right? Like our government is saying, no, we can't talk about that. We can't talk about that.
That strikes me as it's quite hard to hear that actually. I mean, given, you know, I talk in recent seminars about historical trauma, about community trauma, and how people can collectively experience trauma over generations. And I mentioned the death of George Floyd, the murder of George Floyd, and how that epitomizes everything that's wrong. And the fact that you've just told me that that wouldn't be okay to talk about in school, or to talk about the history of your country and the indigenous peoples of your country, that strikes me as bizarre, given what's happened so recently.
Well, what they're referring to is the critical race theory, which is actually a book. It's not actually what people think they're fighting against. What they now are fighting against, and by they I mean the government officials that have made this into legislation, is that we're not going to talk about what actually happened historically. And to me, like, that is, if we're going to move through preventing trauma, we have to look at every aspects of our culture, right? Whether it's healthcare, whether it's historical trauma, whether it is mass incarceration, whatever those pieces are, we have to be able to talk about it.
And we have to learn from the past. Yeah, we have to learn from our past mistakes. Absolutely. We've got to be open to that. And we've got to make ourselves vulnerable to admitting the things that we got wrong, you know. And that goes for at a national level, but it also goes profession by profession. You know, absolutely, we have to look back at what we've done to people in the past in the interests of advancing our profession and recognize that we got it wrong. You know, sometimes we got it badly wrong. And it's all right to acknowledge that we got it wrong,
right?
Because we want to learn from that and we want to move forward. But yeah, everything should be on the table. You know, with this whole movement of being trauma sensitive, that also means acknowledging mistakes, you know?
Right. And at the end of the day, what I've learned is that, and it's been said to me, that the system is working how it was designed, right? That the design of both of our countries, yours being much more historical than ours, are working exactly how they were designed. And so when there's a disruption, and COVID, I think, played a huge role in this disruption, whether natural or man-made, the equilibrium gets off and people start having conversations that they may never have had because the system is completely in disarray. And I think it's by no chance that everything that happened here in the U.S. happened when it did. I think that it is on purpose, because it's time to have these conversations. As a parent who has a 10-year-old, I have open conversations with my own child, and I have for many years, about the impact of historical trauma. And so I don't know. It's just there's a lot of work to do. And I appreciate your global perspective. I appreciate you going, no, these are conversations that we need to have on a big scale, and starting this global resiliency incubator. I think it's accelerator. I'm sorry. We got to incubate before we accelerate, right? I think we're incubating right now.
That's probably a better one, actually.
So no matter what, I appreciate it. So the last question I have, and I told you that was going to go really fast, is from your perspective, and you're not a traditional educator. You are definitely an educator, and I want you to know that. Everything you do is educating. What do you want educators to know who might be listening to this podcast?
Okay. Well, the first thing I think that stands out for me, both from my own experience, but also from the research evidence, is that it's how you feel. It's whether you feel secure and connected and you feel like you matter and you feel like there are safe adults around you, people that make you feel that you count for something. They're the things that stay with you for the rest of your life. Yeah. They're the things that I take from the good parts of my educational journeys, the teachers that made me feel like I had something. I honestly think if you both, I know this from the research, but I also know from my own experiences, if you feel emotionally cared for whilst you're at school, whilst you're in education, the chances are your adult life, you'll see some success and some satisfaction in that. From a really important life course study that was done by the London School of Economics, they found that the worst predictor of adult life success and satisfaction was educational attainment whilst in primary and secondary school. The most important predictor of adult success and life satisfaction at the age of 34 across a whole range of measures was whether that child felt emotionally secure.
Wow.
Emotional well-being was the strongest predictor of positive life outcomes. So I would say in England, we've got a very, very attainment-driven system. We've got a very much a league table kind of system whereby it's all about exam results and teachers are under huge amounts of pressure to meet those targets, and head teachers are under great amounts of pressure to meet those targets and to be at the top of the league tables. So it's all about exam results. And I think schools, you know, not because teachers didn't sign up for the right reasons, not because they don't care about the young people they work with, but very often the system, the machine that they're a part of, means that they don't have the time or the permission or the circumstance to be emotionally available to their students and to prioritize, not even prioritize, to balance educational attainment with emotional safety and emotional well-being. So I think, you know, if you're in a place where you're able to offer that emotional security, to be that safe adult, to be that trusted person for a young child or for a young person, that might be the most important thing in their life. You know, they might not have a safe adult at home in the community. They might not have an appropriate role model. So, you know, a few weeks, I do work with schools, and I often feel like an imposter, but I do sometimes get convinced to support schools, and I enjoy it. I think it's important. But one teacher said to me a few weeks ago, everything you say about trauma, everything you say about psychology and education and child development all makes sense. However, I'm not equipped for this. I have a young girl who comes to me. She's 15. She comes to me every week and tells me about her problems. She tells me about horrendous life circumstances, and I can't do anything about it. And I said, hold on. She comes back to you every week. You listen to her. She trusts you. You're a safe adult to this young girl. And she keeps coming back, and she keeps unburdening herself and trusting you with what's going on in her life. And no, you can't fix it, but you're that safe adult.
Absolutely.
You're the person she can go to every single week. She knows you're there for her. She knows that you're going to listen to her and treat her respectfully. That's going to help. You might be the most important person in her life. So I think, you know, don't underestimate the importance of being a social role model, of being a safe adult, of being a buffer for that stress that's coming from outside of school. And I think the final thing I would say to educators is, you know, you do an incredibly important job. You are the frontline public health intervention. You know, you are the ones that are creating the brains and the bodies of the next generation. You know, so it's a hugely important role. I recognize that often you're undervalued as educators, but I think it's one of the most important roles in our society. So, you know, I have a huge amount of respect for teachers and educators. And I would say, look after yourself, because in clinical psychology, which is my profession, every month, if I'm practicing clinically, I have to have a clinical supervision meeting with somebody who's experienced in my profession, who talks to me about the work, who helps me unburden to make sense of. There's a restorative aspect to it. There's an accountability aspect to it. There's a learning opportunity. So I should go away from that meeting feeling empowered and valued and stimulated and motivated to do the job that I signed up for, the job that I love. No, a lot of professions don't have that. And I recognize that's not available to every teacher or every educator. And I think it should be. So I would say create some opportunity to have that restorative, stimulating, you know, professional accountability conversation where it's about the work. It's not about management. It's not about ticking off a list of tasks. It's about you and how you're coping and how you're feeling and whether you're feeling appreciated.
And I think I have a good solution for that. If you don't know about the Happy Teacher Revolution, I want you to look in that. Dana Thomas was on this podcast, and that's exactly what she has developed, is a way for teachers to connect, affirm, and validate to themselves and to those who they work with. It is such a powerful process. We actually engage in the Happy Teacher Revolution circles. at my school every month. I don't participate. It's for teachers by teachers. And it is almost like clinical supervision of your own affirmations and your own accountabilities to take care of yourself, which is absolutely imperative in this work. And I appreciate you ending with that because that's true. But I do have one more question. And that is, if people want to follow you or your work, where can they find you, especially on social media? Where can they find you to follow you?
Okay. So mostly, so I have a website, www.warrenlarkinassociates.co.uk. On Twitter, I suppose I spend most of my social media time on Twitter. So it's Warren_Larkin. And you can find me on LinkedIn as well. I do have a YouTube channel. I've no idea how to find it. I think you just put my name in and it appears. But yeah, my website's got lots of blogs, lots of keynote addresses, lots of seminars, videos, written pieces, all kinds of stuff. So yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you for that. And as a reminder, don't forget that we have the Trauma Informed Educators Network conference coming up in about a month. So we have 48 sessions from people. We have some representation from the UK, by the way. We have 48 sessions, 2 keynote speakers, 1 professional panel of experts to share. But most of all, it's an opportunity to join around 300 fellow disruptors to unite in this work and to build connections with people around the globe doing this work. And it is an international conference. I would be amiss if I didn't mention again, I know I talked about it earlier in the podcast, one of our partners in the conference, and that's Stop It Solutions. And they're designed to protect the physical, social, and emotional safety and well-being of students, employees, and families by equipping them with a safeguard technology and education. They link caring adults to prevent the preventable and uncover the unseen by helping intervene in the imminent and the earliest possible point through a app system. It is amazing. And then also another piece, and this goes to that self-care that I think is really important, is we are partnering with Empower You, an organization dedicated to help improving the access to vital social and emotional skills and support building student resilience, persistence, and success. And they also have a piece for educator wellness and self-care that is a self-guided paced process doing exactly what Dr. Warren suggested to all of us of taking care of yourself. So thank you all for joining this podcast again this week. And as always, please, 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 if you need to, wear a mask and always wash your hands.